Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. We're going to begin with the latest on health and healing and how different nutrients can protect your heart, even the rhythm of your heart, how to extend the lifespan of your DNA, and how to repair the DNA using natural and non-toxic methods. We're also going to talk about the Great Depression, why so many people are in a strange mood today. Apathy prevails, and it's all ages. What can we do about it? And then we have Chris Hedges going to talk about the best case scenario, the likely outcome, if we continue not becoming proactive. Early this morning, I watched a clip. It was from Stanford University, and one of the originators on Facebook, one of the top executives, talked about how he's given up on the whole internet as far as making it a central part of his life because he said it's very addictive and very destructive. He was talking with a group of people who he believed would be the leaders of the future. He made some extremely insightful points. I do not agree with all that he said, but probably tomorrow I will play it. It's about a 10-minute clip. It's just one of the most interesting, insightful ways of understanding how those who run Silicon Valley, those who are considered the best and brightest, how they perceive reality now and in the future. Also, the idea that Amazon and Apple and Facebook and Google should be broken up. This is going to be a longer clip, but we're only going to play 5 minutes today, and I agree with them. I don't believe that people realize how much control corporations have over our buying processes, our decisions, who we elect, what we do, what we show up to demonstrate, what we don't demonstrate. They virtually control our lives today. Edward Bernays would be proud today. He was the father of American propagandizing. Also, I have a guest in the second part of our program. This you'll find of interest. I'm having on a professor, Alexander Kish. He is a professor of Islamic studies at the Institute of Near Eastern Studies, University of Michigan. And we're going to talk about the rise of the Salafi and Wahhabi violence against the mystics of Islam, the Sufis. In this discussion, we will talk about which of the nations that are Muslim are following the teachings of Wahhabi, because they will tend to be the most radicalized and violent, and which are not. We will try to break it down so that everyone can understand it, not suggesting one is better than the other, but what is the level of conditioning. Remember, we are all products of our conditioning. A couple weeks ago, I talked about something from the past. This would have been 1945, how between 1945 and 1946, actually not all of 1945, just about half of it, you had in Germany and Czechoslovakia and Poland, 2 million women were raped, thousands were killed, and you had the concentration camps being emptied. What I didn't mention, however, was there was no place for them to go. There was no plan in place because many of the Allies had never experienced anything like the death camps. They'd never seen them before. They didn't know they existed. So what do you do with all of these people, and many of whose family had also perished? Well, we had no relocation program. On another show, I'll get to the whole idea of what happened with 40 million people who were, in effect, migrants. They were trying to get home from Poland, Czechoslovakia, Italy, Spain, and France, Belgium. How was all that handled? By the way, you'll be surprised by the answer. It was not handled by the Americans. the French and the British. I'll explain who actually helped all those people, especially the children. That's a separate historical lesson about the children who were wandering the streets of Berlin and other countries without parents, without money, without food, and how they actually survived. A remarkable story. But one of the things that was happening was that vengeance was being meted out on a substantial level. In 1946 and 47 at the Nuremberg trials, which lasted almost 9 months, very few people were actually held accountable, only about 21 actually. When you consider how many people did it take to commit genocide, how many people oversaw the concentration camps, how many people oversaw the transportation, like Eichmann, of getting the people from where you wanted to take them, the Warsaw ghettos, or into a concentration camp. Should not they also be held accountable? They knew what they were doing. They knew where these people were going. They were participants. And that led to what was known as the good German theory. There were no good Germans. Well, of course there were good Germans. There were Germans who were actually against Hitler and against what was happening. But when people had a chance to respond to all that had happened to them, the deprivation, the killing, the genocide, there was no measure of civility. I'll explain how bad it got and what happened. But how do people do that? How? Then I ask this question. What would happen if we no longer made it against the law? You would not be arrested if you stole or if you committed murder or acts of violence against anyone. What would happen if we no longer made it a crime to rape people, to abuse them? What if you then took out all the windows of all the stores, the jewelry stores? What do you think America would be like in 24 hours? The same? Different? It's a hypothetical question. I want you to think of what constrains us, what prevents us from repelling down to the darkest aspects of the limbic brain, the reptilian character within us all. How is it that some people, given the opportunity to do wrong, to lie, to deceive, to cheat, to manipulate, will not do so? They refuse to. And not necessarily because of what it would mean to you, the victim, but what it would mean to them, their spiritual being, that they do not want to dishonor. One little caveat I left out of the yesterday's discussion about what happened with Michael. When all the doctors before showed he had a degeneration of the lower spine, could not be reversed medically, and then afterwards found that when he came back and has felt such wonderful energy, was a different person, the examination's x-ray showed that nothing had changed. And I said, but something had changed. What I forgot to add in was, over the next 16 months, he completely reversed the physical condition. He was totally healed. So then what Harry Edwards said was he brought Michael, the conditioned self, to Michael, the spiritual self, and harmonized those energies. And by harmonizing the healing energy, it allowed then the body to engage in a healing process. What happens if you're living a life of higher ideals? What if you choose not to lie or cheat or steal or manipulate? What if you choose not to profit at someone else's loss? What if you choose to look at individuals irrespective of their color, their ethnicity, their cultural standing, their education, as anything less than a sacred being? So whether you were a chairman of a department emeritus or whether you had never been to school, you were still given the same equal consideration of being a sacred soul. Where would the room for violence be? Where would the perspective of violence be? You wouldn't have one. You wouldn't engage in it. So if we are so capable of being self-destructive and socially destructive, if we are killing our environment, moving where we shouldn't live, and living in environments that we have destroyed our capacity for balance, for harmony, and for being able to maintain nature as it should be, sustainable, not exploiting its finite resources. It's trees, it's water, it's land. Then what does it say about us as human beings and our capacity to deal with our honest problems if we are capable of doing the right thing or if we're incapable of doing the right thing? And what is the measure of determining our conditioning? So when I look at atrocities around the world, when I see what people are capable of and doing to each other and have done historically, Germans to others, and then others to the Germans, then that's all conditioning, because the German children were taken into special schools and taught how evil and bad the Jews were. So by the time they were out of school, they were already perfect candidates for the SS and therefore had no feelings or remorse, no sense of empathy for their victims. What does wealth accumulation and sacrificing all that was moral do for the doctor that gives you chemotherapy, knowing it's not going to help you, probably hurt you, will hurt you? Or the rheumatologist who for decades said there's no connection between diet and disease, arthritis, none. There's no food that will help you if you have arthritis or cure you. And all that was wrong. And yet that's what they chose. How do you uncondition that kind of mind? How do you uncondition the person that prides themselves on their ism, that they live through the identity of an ism, capitalism, socialism, communism, Marxism? Aren't we more than our conditioned beliefs, or are we exclusively our conditioned beliefs, where once in a while, when we're completely relaxed, non-threatened, our conscious mind sees what we have created and says, hold on, stop. Stop what you're doing. Get a grip. You're not going to like the outcome. I'll go into this in greater depth on a program when we have a video audio clip tomorrow to share with you. Now into health and healing. Potassium. According to the University of Surrey and Cambridge University, both of which are in the United Kingdom, potassium, a very important macro mineral, as important as magnesium for your heart, is critical to circadian rhythms in human and red blood cells. Now, what does this mean? It means that an innovative new study from the Universities of Surrey and Cambridge in their molecular biology department, published in the Journal of Nature Communications, has uncovered the secrets of the circadian rhythms in red blood cells and identified potassium as the key mystery to this. Red blood cells, by the way, are similar to other cells in the body. They have 24-hour biological clocks, meaning that that's their circadian rhythm, that alter their activity between day and night. And unlike other cells, red blood cells do not have DNA, and the clock genes that control rhythms are not present. Until now, it has been unknown how such cells are regulated. And using a novel technique, they found that potassium was regulating this. So what does this mean for us? It means that if you want to have a healthier blood chemistry, then make sure you're taking your potassium supplementation or eating foods or drinking liquids like coconut water, which is a great way to rehydrate your body and give yourself the potassium you need. That regulates then the circadian rhythms of your red blood cells. So that means in the early evening, if you have some coconut water or a banana or a supplement of, let's say, 200 or 300 milligrams of potassium, that your red blood cells will be in balance and harmonizing with the body's natural rhythms, which means they'll be healthier. And that means that your whole circulatory system will be improved. Now, think of diabetics and pre-diabetics, people with all forms of arterial problems, arterial sclerosis, hardening of the arteries, the poor circulatory venue we have, our epithelium, which is all torn up. All that would be impacted. Plus, you would have healthy red blood flow. So, something new, interesting. One little piece to the puzzle. And this is from Trinity College in Dublin. Time of the day affects severity of autoimmune disease. This is also Nature Communication. Insights into how the body clock and time of day influence your immune responses are revealed in this study. And so understanding the effect of the interplay between 24-hour day-night cycles in the immune system can help reform drug targeting or nutrient targeting or functional food and functional juice targeting to alleviate autoimmune disease. So here is the takeaway message. Here's how I put it in lay language. We should be consuming nutrients throughout the day. Those nutrients should have a lifespan of anywhere from an hour to maybe 4 or 5 hours. Nutrients don't last long in your system if they're water-soluble. They do last much longer if they're oil-based, like vitamin A or vitamin D, for example, or oil-based. So if you make sure that you have a lot of good nutrients in the morning, let's say a smoothie, in which you have your berries and your nuts and seeds and maybe some coconut oil and flaxseed oil, all that is terrific. And what it does, it gives you the nutrients so that your immune system has what it needs during that morning period to be strong and vital. The basophils, neutrophils, and phagocytes and leukocytes, they're all working on your behalf because you're feeding them. You're giving them what they need. And you're giving them juices. Now, in the early afternoon, I do what's called grazing. Might have an avocado with some raw onion and lemon juice spritzed on it. And that's enough. That's just grazing. That's wonderful nutrition. Then a little later, you might have something else. You're grazing throughout the day. Some handful of sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, sesame seeds, or hummus dip. You're feeding your body. As long as you spread your nutrients out throughout the day and into the early evening, that means that the immune system is constantly being fed. What we do now is we wake up, we're rushed, we go to work, people have coffee or a bagel or toast, but there's nothing to feed the immune system, and therefore the immune system is not working on their behalf 24/7. So be in balance with your body's natural rhythms. Keep that balance throughout the day. Exercising the morning helps that. Exercising the evening, even for a half hour, helps that. Meditating in the morning helps it. Meditating in the evening helps it. It's all in the rhythm. This is from Bringing to University. It says that your mood depends upon the food you eat, and what you should eat changes as you get older. I would agree with that. I believe that what we're not doing is we're not looking at our glycemic index, meaning, let's say that you have some brown rice. Your blood sugar will be going across and then it'll have a slight elevation. But let's say you have a bagel or a donut or some kind of sugar drink. Your blood sugar spikes. And when your blood sugar spikes, everything spikes with it. Cortisol spikes. Your stress hormones spike when your blood sugar spikes. And then it drops down, and frequently it drops down below your base, below where you should be. Now you have fatigue. And with that fatigue comes irritability. And you're not able to focus. So then you have something else to get you out of that little doldrum. So you start on this roller coaster. So by having the right foods that stabilize your mood, whole grains, whole legumes, not processed foods, then your blood sugar is stable and your mood is stable. I can predict your mood based upon the food that you eat. I even did a book on this in a PBS special years ago called The Food-Mood Connection. Especially with kids, it's essential that you make sure that your children start the day with a really healthy smoothie, something with the right proteins, vegetable proteins, without the sugars, so that they're not bouncing off the wall. And suddenly their whole mood changes. They're not the irritable way. And in fact, in the afternoon, when kids get cranky, people think all they need is a nap. Well, nap may be what they need, but also you should stabilize their blood sugar, bring it up from being down at that point. Again, 3 or 4 ounces of a smoothie will do that. And one of the ways you know you're stabilizing your blood sugar is to put some almond butter or cashew butter or pistachio butter or sunflower or sesame or let's say chia seed butters into a smoothie. That'll absolutely stabilize, and that's really terrific for diabetic and pre-diabetic. Studies suggest being proud may protect against falls in older people, University of Stirling and Aberdeen in the United Kingdom. This says, quote, contrary to the old saying, pride comes before a fall, the opposite appears to be true, according to an article published in the British Medical Journal. Falls affect a large proportion of the older adults, sometimes leading to injury and death. And the cost of the falls to the government is into the billions of dollars a year. And some falls can be prevented by targeting interconnections in people who have discovered characteristics such as impaired mobility and gait. But this also means that you have to have the confidence not to fear falling. So the being able to have the confidence that you can do something means that you're more likely to try to do something. And that trying to do something takes you out of feeling like, if I do anything at all, I'm going to fall. Well, then that's where mindful meditation comes in. Minding the idea that in this moment, I'm not going to fall. I'm going to take my time and I'm going to get up and I'm going to walk. If I need to walk with a cane, I'll do that, or a walker, I'll do it, but I'm going to get up and I'm going to do something and I'm going to have confidence that I can do it. And if I do it, I'm going to feel good about myself. Self-confidence is the cornerstone of putting yourself into a place to grow. And there are times when that's going to be rough and painful and stressful, and that's just fine. Because if we are never taught or self-taught or mentored that there are going to be times when things are going to be tough, then we're never going to try anything. There's a whole generation of millennials now who are doing kickboxing, and women are in gyms more than men now, boxing. Yeah, you're going to get some bruised knuckles. You're going to end up with some pulled muscles. But you're also going to have the confidence, the self-confidence that, yeah, I did that. Now I'm better able to be more athletic. I can better protect myself. And that's a good thing. That gives you self-confidence. So we've got to put ourselves in a position of going through discomfort in order to have that confidence. With something as simple as being able to walk and without saying, no, I'm going to fall. That's what the study's showing. And finally, high-intensity exercise delays Parkinson's progression. This is really good news. This is from Northwestern Medical University and the University of Denver. And it says, high-intensity exercise 3 times a week is safe for individuals with early-stage Parkinson's disease and decreases worsening of motor symptoms. I think that's terrific. I know that when we were doing our study on the brain, we had everybody exercising twice a day, every day, and 6 days a week, I should say, not 7. And they made major improvements. And a lot of that exercise had to be high intensity, meaning they couldn't take it easy. It's called a junk exercise. You got to push yourself. You got to go beyond some barriers. But look at what it does. Wow, it's terrific. And oh, by the way, one last thing here. Well, there's two. One's from Copenhagen University saying young diabetics could have 700% higher risk of sudden cardiac death. Now, why is that important? Because we have an epidemic of young people in America who have adult 2 diabetes. So we're putting them at 700% increased risk of sudden death. In this study, this is from the Investigations Study Unit in Cardiovascular Disease at the University of Spain, published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, says half of people age 45 or 40 to 54 have hardening of the arteries. Half. Wow. Let me put it a different way. Based upon our lifestyle and based upon our sedentary activity and based upon being glued to computers and televisions and telephones, we're not mobile as we were. And we're not athletic as we once were. And so that and pizzas and colas and all that fructose, that causes damage to the inner artery wall, the epithelium. And that's where your clots frequently occur. But that and also the quality of the diet. With a diet that is very high in fats, which most diets are, your red blood cells can clump, aggregate together, and that's also a way that we die. So we have an epidemic of overweight people, younger people in their 30s and 40s, and on this study showing 50%, 50%, who would have thought that we're that unhealthy in America with all of our education and all the opportunity we have? Yeah, we are. So, wow. You're going to be dying younger? And why? Because even though you're 40 or 45, your arteries and your heart, your liver and kidneys and brain are not 40 or 45. They could be 80, 85. That's what happens. We're two ages. Always remember this. We're two ages, our chronological age and our biological age. The chronological age is really irrelevant. Your biological age is highly relevant. That's what causes you to live or die. So pay attention. Remember, the solution is exercising twice a day, eating a plant-based, healthy, organic diet, de-stressing and mindful meditation and yoga, and then knowing what the purpose of your life is and honoring it at the highest spiritual level. Then you can reverse that. So the good news is you can reverse a lot of this. From our studios in New York, and you can watch this program tonight on Facebook. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Tomorrow I'll be, in fact, I may give this information today if I have time, about the premiere of my new feature film. It's a hard-hitting film, the hardest-hitting film I've ever done, and I've done some real hard-hitting films. It's a private showing. I'm limiting the number of people who can come. The major worldwide premiere will be in about 3 to 4 weeks from now. And I'll announce more on it. But for right now, and I'm going to ask Jesse if he could give me the information from it's on my desk, and I will then share that with you. If you want to listen live over the telephone and you're not available to listen on a land-based station, what we call a terrestrial station, or over the Internet, let me give you the phone number to listen live every day, Monday to Friday, at noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, 424-203-8046, 424-203-8046. This is the archive number. When you have no time to listen, and then in the evening, you say, okay, I'm going to catch up. See what Gary had to talk about today. Call this number, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. And if we had people yesterday who couldn't get in on the phone, but did email us, and their responses, and I have a lot of those. You can always email your response to any question that we have that's a talkback question, prnstudio@gmail.com, prnstudio@gmail.com. And we're going to go to Richard Garrell in a moment. I've decided to do something a little different because I was thinking, gee whiz, if I was a radio audience person and I'm not interested in the environment, would I want to hear three straight days on the environment? The answer would be probably not. So what I'm going to do is this. Starting this evening at 7 p.m., I'm going to be presenting the part one of a four-part series. The last part is all about solutions with a whole panel of some of the best minds in the world talking about what we can do to save our planet, or at least that part of our planet and that part of the population and species that can be saved. And it starts tonight, and that is the most comprehensive, in-depth understanding of our environment. And if you have a friend that may be a climate change denialist, ask them to listen and see if any human being, after hearing the presentation that's taken nearly all told 10 years, and I have to credit our executive producer, Richard Gale, who is one of our scholars in residence, who has spent thousands of hours on this. I've spent thousands of hours interviewing people, doing research, and this is the consequence, this white paper. So we're going to do it over the next 4 weeks on Tuesday in the Progressive Commentary Hour. You won't want to miss it, because you wouldn't even know so many of the tipping points, over 40 tipping points. 10 years ago, there were seven. Now there are 40. And when these tip, they have incredible consequences to people around the world. Right now, we're seeing one part of that tipping point manifest in California with the fires. And Jerry Brown finally acknowledged on 60 Minutes on Sunday night, this past Sunday night, that, yeah, this is a part of global warming. What he didn't take responsibility for is continuing to allow a state to be overpopulated, to have resources that are not abundant and sustainable in the state, and that's the politician in him, and that's the developers in the state, and that's the communities who need the tax base. They're not willing to be honest and say, friend, you shouldn't be living here at this time, nor even in the future. Might have been good in the past. It's not going to be good now or in the future, because there's no safe space in the state. The whole state's on fire. It was on fire earlier up north. Now it's all down south, and it's bad fires. Now, in time, they will put these fires out. But then where exactly is their safe place? And that's just from the drought. That's just from the extremes. And I predicted this. If you remember, I predicted this when they were having torrential rains. I said these rains are not good. Temporarily, they'll fill the reservoirs, but they're also causing untold number of seedlings to start to sprout. Now, in the fall and winter, that will dry up again when there's no rain, and that will be the basis of your next major state forest fire. And that's exactly what happened. That's what we're seeing. And this is a cycle that's going to be 12 months a year now. There won't be a day where there's not something going on in the state. So exactly why would anyone want to be where you've got earthquakes that are going to happen and the consequences of pollution from the hydrofracking and oil drilling, and which is major all around Los Angeles and all over the state, where you have a depletion of water that is not coming back, and you have severe drought and heat is increasing. So the avocado crop was just wiped out for the whole country. Only a tiny amount of avocados are going to be available. That whole area that the fire went through, that was your avocado area. Well, it's the seventh largest economy in the world, but they're not looking at the consequences of that. They just looked at how they could pride themselves on making themselves a high-level economy instead of a sustainable place to live. I'm going to deal with everything involving the environment, all documented, starting tonight. Let people know. It'll be a four-part series. You'll want to catch each part. Now, here is the title of my new feature film, Deadly Deception. That's it. It is very limited. Now, normally when I do a New York premiere, I'll do one out in Long Island, Huntington Arts, I'll do one up in Woodstock. I can't do that now. This is a private screening that members of this radio audience is being invited to until the seats are filled, and they will fill instantly. And here is where you call. I'm just going to give you a phone number, and you'll call, and each person coming to the film will get a copy of the film to take home with them, and I'll be there, and we'll have a discussion afterwards. 212-864-5400. 212-864-5400. And where you can go and get tickets online at symphonyspace.org. Symphonyspace.org. Okay, it's next Thursday, 7 p.m. Next Thursday, the 21st, 7 p.m., a private limited showing, not a big showing, private limited showing. And then we burst out worldwide in about 3 weeks. And I mean burst out. Press conferences in Washington, New York, panelists from all over the world. You have no idea how big this is. This is just, I always promise to do a small showing. This is a small private showing. Deadly Deception. Most powerful, hard-hitting film I've ever done in my career. And I've done a lot of hard-hitting films. Now let's go over and say hello to our executive producer, Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Richard, I wanted to have you on to talk about something that I'm paying attention to. I watch all the different shows briefly each day to see what they're covering and how they're covering it and who they're having on as their experts, and are they qualifying these experts and showing their conflicts of interest, which foundations or think tanks they belong to and who funds those. And more often than not, both on MSNBC and on CNN, these are often from the Council on Foreign Relations or the Free Press Institute or the Cato Institute. These are neocons. These are neoliberal philosophies. But there is something I do want to give credit to. I take major issue with Sean Hannity on probably 90% of the things he talks about, the issues he takes on. I would take just the opposite. However, I do believe that he has done the right job in bringing to the public's attention many of the facts that we did not know about the Russian oil deal and who's been involved and the conflicts of interest and why the mainstream media won't cover it. So when someone does do something that is legitimate and worthy, I think they should be given credit for it. So I'm giving him credit for that, even though I will explain all the issues that I disagree with him on. Now I compare that to the mainstream media, and there's nothing that they're doing I agree with. To the contrary, the issues that they refuse to investigate, are legion. And Richard's here to continue that. Richard, talk about some of the issues that the mainstream media, left and right, will not touch. We do, but they won't touch it.
Well, I think, unfortunately, so much of our mainstream media is full of so many frivolous stories of the most recent kitten that falls into the septic system that we don't. There's not even the time spent for all the very important urgent issues. Our news sources today are really speaking and addressing the 5% people. You know, an honest editorial by mainstream media should really say, well, we deeply value the 5 to 7% of you listeners out there who make tons of money and believe that their growing riches are going to be helping everyone else. So much of our media, and I think if we understand it, that's where they're coming from. We can greater appreciate why they spin the news, why there's so much denial of many of the different facts. Just taking climate change, for example, in one recent year, I think it was 2015, there were 450 mainstream broadcast news segments on climate or on weather events, but only 16 of those even mentioned climate change. So you can say, I mean, even to make an association with anthropogenic climate change. So that's one issue. I don't remember hearing a report about the acidification of the oceans. The coverage of the international trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Partnership Agreements. When were we told that these were all secret deals that were held in closed doors with private industry and the banking systems? We don't hear of how many bankers remain on Wall Street despite all the crimes that they've committed. There's a long list. You hear the main headline, but not what's behind it. Beehive collapse due to pesticides. All the corruption and inside dealings of Monsanto, the carcinogenic risks of glyphosate and GMOs, or just what's happening in rural communities due to hydrofracking and the toxic chemical poisoning of water systems. When has anybody really reported all the science that we report almost every week? There's some story on junk food in the American diet associated with obesity and diabetes. We don't hear that science being spoken of. Greg Palast's wonderful work on voter fraud and stolen elections, and this, you know, award-winning BBC investigative reporter who's uncovered so much information on this, but we don't hear about that. When was the last time we heard of the association of psychiatric drugs with all the mass killings and shootings in schools or on military bases? When do we hear of the most recent popular pharmaceutical drug that is being prescribed to hundreds of thousands of people that receives a black box warning? The guest who's going to be coming on, just the image of Islam that the mainstream media portrays, and he could probably address that better, or the truth about ISIS. I mean, it's a long list that we could go through, including the U.S. Relationship with al-Qaeda and the events in Syria, Libya, or the truthful story, as we covered before, with people on the ground in Aleppo speaking about the white helmets and their association with some of the radical extremist groups in that region. The American role in the genocide occurring right now with Yemen. So these are all stories that the mainstream media either it's more of a reporting of omission. You get the kind of fuzzy headline, but it's the details are what are ignored. So we only get a very, very small sliver of truth.
I would agree with that, and that's when was last time that any of the mainstream media actually did an original investigation on the safety and efficacy of vaccines? Now, I've spent over 15,000 hours researching this, as have other doctors in the field, and our research is based upon looking at all the evidence. I've yet to see a single reporter for a single news outlet do any of this research. They immediately go to the National Institutes of Health. They'll go to the Dr. Fauci, or one of the people over at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, or the CDC or the FDA, and claim to be the ultimate source, and anyone who challenges them is unscientific or pseudoscientific or a quack. No, the only quackery that's out there is supporting orthodox science and medical science that has been completely manipulated. Even Dr. Angell, that we interviewed, said this in the New England Journal of Medicine. She was the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, I think, for 22 years now. She's a professor at Harvard. Or the doctor that we filmed and interviewed in Europe, what's his name, Goetz?
Goetze from the University of Copenhagen.
And he said American Medicine Day is like the mafia. Didn't he equate them to the mafia?
Yes. Well, he wrote a book.
And he's one of the most respected medical doctors in the world. He's part of the Cochrane Group, one of the most respected group of scientists in the world. Why isn't any of the mainstream media, why aren't the liberal media on this, all over this? You don't see these are excluded from the conversation. And for decades, the mainstream media and the alternative media have refused to look at the fraud that went on with AZT, the first drug that made billions, tens of billions of dollars for Burroughs Wellcome. And then they used that money to buy groups, the influence groups in the United States who took their money and then had to align with their, you know, take the drug early, not realizing or realizing and choosing to deny how deadly that drug was. Well, I went up against them. Now, I saw, you know, they push back. Fine. They can push all they want, but didn't move me from the facts. I had the facts. They did not. Yet the media wouldn't touch that story. Still to this day won't touch that story. And those who did were not in the mainstream media. It was the alternatives that tried it. So our truths today are almost always coming from people outside of the mainstream. When was the last time we heard the truth from the mainstream about 9/11? We haven't. Now, they don't have to believe in any conspiracy theory. All they have to do is say, is the official report accurate? There is no human being on earth that could prove that the official report on 9/11 is accurate. In fact, the authors of the report, the former governor of New Jersey, said that it's not accurate. Yet we're not told the truth. So I think it's time that we realize that both the alternative and mainstream media have substantially biased themselves out of being considered authentic on any level, because what they won't cover, they won't touch. When was the last time any of the mainstream media covered geoengineering? There's absolute proof that we've been geoengineering. But what are the consequences of it? Why won't they look at the consequences? They won't. They won't look at any of this. How about the government's secret underground city that they built? Now, Jesse Ventura actually drove into it. He got stopped in the tunnel that led to it, but no one talks about it. Why should they have an advantage if there's a disaster? Why should we all be victims and they saved? It's what the media will not touch that bothers me. Well, we're bothering the media now. We're bothering these institutions. And yeah, there'll be pushback, and that's fine. We expect it, and they can do all the harassing and toxic campaigns they want, but it's not going to stop the truth from getting out, at least to the people who are willing to look at the truth. So, Richard, thanks for all the good work you did on the environmental segment. We'll be starting that tonight, 7 o'clock. Nobody wants to miss that. You don't want to miss this program tonight. You do not want to miss it. You want to share it. You give it to people and say, this is the truth. If you don't believe it's the truth, find where a single statement in here is wrong. Find where anything is wrong. If you listen to this and you can't be behind really doing something about the environment, then you're the problem. Thanks a lot, Richard. We're going to go over to our guest now, who is standing by, and he's on Skype, and I gave you his name earlier, Dr. Alexander Knish, and he is a professor of Islamic studies at the Institute for Near Eastern Studies, University of Michigan, and his areas of specialty are Islamic mysticism, or Sufism, and intellectual history, and Islamic movements in North Africa and Yemen and Russia and the Caucasus. And he received his doctorate at the Institute of Oriental Studies, the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And he's here with us to talk. And he is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Islamic Mysticism. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
In recent years, there has been growing incidences of fundamentalist committing violence against the Sikhs and the mosques and the tombs and the pilgrimage gatherings of Sufi, who represent the mystical element in the Islamic religion. And recently, there was the bombing and shooting of a Sufi mosque just a couple of weeks ago in the Sinai by ISIS, and killing over 300 people, perhaps the largest massacre done by Muslims against Muslims in recent times. And more recently, Sufi mosques and centers have been targeted by Islamic extremists in Libya, and there have been many incidences of violence against Sufis in Pakistan and Bangladesh over recent years. And last year, there was the assassination of a famous Sufi musician from the Sabri family in Pakistan. And there was also the spree of Sufi holy men and Sikhs and their family members being hacked to death with machetes in Bangladesh. And on one hand, this should inform the Western public and those who wish to understand this, that this is not a monolithic religion. It is far more diverse than what the mainstream media and politicians would have you believe. The same is true for Christianity and Judaism, which also have their spectrum ranging from mystical and liberal and moderate to the far-right extremist. And one of America's favorite allies, Saudi Arabia, and its Wahhabi state religion has outlawed Sufism for a very long time. So I'd like you to explain to us the principal tenets of Wahhabism and Salafism that lend themselves to violence and terrorism, and what is the relationship between the Salafi and Wahhabism, and then what are the most salient tenets of Sufism that make it a target by Islamic fundamentalists? The forum is yours.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me, because indeed, I think we should educate the American public about the divisions within Islam, which are very serious. The one division in particular that you just mentioned is between Salafis and Sufis. Salafis, I would say, represent a more or less fundamentalist approach to the Quran. They read it literally, whereas the Sufis read it allegorically. They try to find references to the hidden message of the Quran, whereas the Salafis say the Quran just says what it says and you shouldn't delve too deep, because otherwise you will be reading something that you have in your mind into the Quran. So there is a contradiction between Salafis and Sufis over how to read and understand the Quran. But there are also contradictions between them and disagreements over practices. Sufis practice visits to the tomb of their great masters, the sheikhs. And the Salafis see these visits as a manifestation of idolatry. And if we know Islamic history, we know that Islam emerged as a response to the pagan beliefs, to the idolatry of the Arabian tribes. So the fundamentalists who deny that people should go and visit Sufi tombs, they argue that the tombs serve as idols, which were prohibited by the Prophet Muhammad and the Quran, and therefore the practices that are focused on the Sufi tombs and shrines are illegitimate from the viewpoint of pure Islam as they understand it. So on practical and theoretical levels, as you can see, on doctrinal levels, there are serious disagreements. But they are not unlike the disagreements between Catholics and Protestants in Christianity. As you remember, Catholics encouraged the cult of saints, and the Protestants attacked it as also as some form of idolatry, worship of human beings rather than God. So we see a kind of Islamic version of the Protestant-Catholic rivalry and conflict in modern times in Islam between the Salafis, who can be loosely identified as Protestants, and the Sufis, who can be identified as Catholics. So as for the Wahhabism, Wahhabism is a regional manifestation of Salafism that is unique to Saudi Arabia, because that's where it emerged in the middle of the 18th century, and then it spread across the Arabian Peninsula, eventually engulfing the two great sacred cities of Islam, Mecca and Medina. Now the Salafi Wahhabism is the predominant ideology in Saudi Arabia. And as you mentioned quite rightly, Sufism is prohibited, at least officially, from public manifestations in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Explain Sufism and what makes it so unique.
It's unique. It's not unlike Christian monasticism. So Sufis take their religious more seriously than ordinary believers. They actually feel very acutely the divine presence in every moment of their lives. In other words, they experience God while walking in the street. They focus on their thoughts on God throughout their daily activities. Whereas ordinary believers just perform the prayer, then they go about their business, and they do not think much about God or his presence in their life. So one of the characteristic features of Sufi Islam is that focus on the divine presence and the necessity to always think about God and his benevolence and his goodness to human beings. How you manifest your piety, you engage in special practices that are unique to Sufis and that are not practiced by other Muslims, non-Sufi Muslims. For instance, you perform so-called recollection of God. You say Allah, Allah, which means God in Arabic, constantly throughout the day, reminding you again, as I said, about God's invisible presence in your life. Then there are collective recollections, which are called hadras, the collective dhikrs, collective recollections, when Sufis gather together and perform various chants that are also unique to Sufism and which are condemned by Salafis as illicit practices, illegitimate practices from the viewpoint of the pure Islam as they understand it. So I would say also that Sufis tend to renounce this world. They focus on the next life and think that this life, the life in this world with all its delights and enticements, this life is really just a transitory stage which you have to pass like a bridge, across the bridge, and then go to a glorious new life with God. So they do not think much about the value of this world and its values and its enticements and so forth.
Well, we're going to invite you back for a much longer discussion now that you've opened up the door to allow us to look in on Sufism. Your new book is Sufism, A New History of Islamic Mysticism, Princeton University Press. And I want to talk at greater length on an upcoming program about what can we learn from the different nations that are practicing the Sufi philosophy of everything is allegorical in that sense versus the Wahhabist view, and which countries are it most likely to engage in extremist activity against others who do not subscribe to their views in the Middle East or around the world. And so we then take something that's a principle and apply it to the geopolitical movements that we're now seeing. So that will be our next discussion, all right?
Thank you so much for having me.
And that is Professor Alexander Knish. He will be back with us to go into greater depth on this. But we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. And don't forget, tonight you will not want to miss what will be the most comprehensive, in-depth discussion on the environment, everything about the environment, from acid rain and destruction of the Great Lakes and the algae blooms, everything far beyond global warming starts at 7. It'll be over a 4-week period. Have a nice day, everyone.